Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
Listen to what I'm saying. That's right. Bring that camera in here a little bit closer.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the stud is here.
All right, everybody, let's get it done. It's another Studcast with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Hey, y'all, it's David Summers, and here comes the story of wrestling in America as told by the stud, whose family started the profession over 100 years ago. So now, let's step back into the ring, back into time, as we get wall-to-wall, treetop tall, with the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Hey, Ron, I got to tell you, last week's Studcast, number 350, was really one of my favorites so far. You really got serious in the last Hidden History Lesson. I thought it was really awesome about getting the most out of your plans for the newly purchased Birmingham and Northern Alabama back in May of 1980. Then you finished with another great card for the Southeastern Gulf Coast Territory. I thought it was really a great show.
Well, man, I appreciate that, you know. And I certainly didn't hold anything back, man, in that meeting with the Birmingham TV station. And that was going to get us started off really good, man, up there in Birmingham with that weekly TV show. And I have to admit, our Dothan TV connection, Charlie Platt, and our head commentator, Wayne Register, our director, they did an amazing job in Dothan every week at WTVY there, where we produced one of the best wrestling TV shows in the world. You know, few territories invested in big-time advertising beyond their TV show and newspapers. They didn't spend much money. And, you know, they expected that was going to get it done, their show and their newspaper ads. But, boy, I love the impact of those outdoor billboards. And I began using those in 1976, back in the Knoxville days, about my second year as a promoter and owner of a territory. And then I used them again in the Gulf Coast Territory in 1978, all the way from Montgomery to all the cities along the Gulf Coast. And this time I was going to use them in Birmingham area to advertise a new wrestling company that had just arrived there and to help me get a great deal from the local Birmingham TV station manager that was carrying our show.
Okay, so I mean, the thing I thought was really cool, I love the way you presented the billboards idea to the station manager in a way that got him to move your wrestling program time from what I thought was a crazy time just before midnight by your predecessor on Saturdays to 2 p.m. on Saturday afternoon. By showing him that mock billboard with his station and TV program time added to the boards for free, I got a feeling that his information was going to be on the boards anyway, was it not?
Yeah. Yeah, it was, actually, right? And, you know, I was definitely going to put it on there either way. And I think that last card in the last Studcast wasn't very bad either. And we had a great one. It was four main events on the last card. And this Studcast, Dave, I can honestly say is even better than the last one. In fact, it's one of the few cards in any of my companies that I owned in wrestling that had five main events in seven total matches. And one of those was a true superstar that had never been seen in the territory before.
All right, I think about the only thing that we have not touched on coming up today is the Hidden History Lesson in this Studcast. I doubt many owners of territories ever talked about this hidden history subject with any fans, much less all of them, which is what I think you're intending to do here today. Am I right, sir?
Yes, that's correct, man. This should be very interesting. I'm going to talk about the different relationships between wrestling companies that I personally experienced in my 14 years as a wrestling company owner. Those people that I could work with and those that I couldn't. And obviously, it's going to be focused on mostly Southern companies because there's no reason to expect me to get help from owners in far parts of the country, just the territories near you, the guys that would likely work with you. And so I was really lucky to have a great group of those. So one of the things that really happened to me, helped me personally with my four wrestling companies, was the fact I already had worked for so many different territories in the South before I started my first Southeastern company, my first actual wrestling company in 1974. At that point, I had already worked in Georgia, Florida, I'd worked in Memphis, I'd worked in St. Louis, and I had a personal relationship with the owner of the Mid-South Territory, which is just west of me, with Bill Watts. So let's begin this discussion with the first territory I dealt with after opening Southeastern. That would have been in the fall of 1974. It was the closest territory to Knoxville. My grandfather owned half of it, as a matter of fact, and his partner was Nick Gulas. And that was the Mid-American territory and was located in Nashville, Tennessee. And my first experience with them was not a good one, I'd have to say. I bought Knoxville from John Kazana, but he never told me when we were discussing how everything worked that he was paying the Mid-American territory 10% of his gross gate for supplying most of the talent for his two towns that he ran. He ran just two towns a week, basically on Friday in Knoxville, Saturday in a real close town, some little small town close to Knoxville. So then, on Saturday, just about the only talent he personally had that wrestled for him, just him, and not basically for the territory in Nashville, just west of him, was Don Wright and Ron Wright and Whitey Caldwell. And Whitey Caldwell was a great star for him there. And he had died in a car accident just about a year before I came to Knoxville. Mm. Never got to meet him.
Wow.
But I would have not had a near as big a problem with this 10%, if I'd been told about it before I bought the territory. I might not have bought the territory had I realized that was the way things were going to be. And then I found out that, you know, the wrestlers that were promised by Nick Gulas from the Nashville office to wrestle on Friday nights in Knoxville many times didn't even show up at all. And I was paying 10% of the gate for that.
Wow.
You know, that wasn't quite right. I mean, you know, I wasn't getting all my talent from them. I'm giving them 10% of my crowd, my gate, So that's where, you know, I found out John Kazana, he dealt with that for years, but I wasn't a John Kazana. I didn't want to deal with this. So, it was like the kiss of death for a new territory. It meant like every card for Southeastern that we're going to be advertising for Southeastern, every show, it started having at least two or three guys that didn't show up. And someone else would be sent to take their place. And that was called having a substitute, man. And that was a definite no-no if you were in the wrestling business. And to make it even worse, many times those substitutes were guys booked in the main event. So I knew if that continued, I was never going to be successful there.
Wow. Okay. All right. I'm pretty sure it is, but this is the same Nick Gulas that you had that argument with in the Huntsville, Alabama dressing room 3 years before you bought Knoxville, and the same man you purchased Birmingham from in the last studcast. How did you handle this?
Well, that's him. That's the same Nick Gulas. And so after the first 6 weeks in Knoxville, it had happened every week. I called Nick, you know, and I knew he was responsible for getting the guys to the shows and for booking them out. Roy didn't handle that part of it. And so, you know, I told him what was going on, and I told him very plainly, I said, I'm not going to pay any more booking fees. If I don't get every man that you say is going to be on that card to show up there to wrestle for me, I'm not going to pay booking anymore. Well, you know, only because we were separated by 180 miles of interstate between Knoxville and Nashville, Nick went off on me, right? He's gonna tell me what he thinks, right, over the phone. You know, kind of like he did years earlier in the Huntsville dressing room, mm-hmm. first time I met him, basically. You know, and he screamed at me that he and Roy had been getting booking fees from towns all over the South for more than 20 years. And if need be, he said, they wouldn't mind, Roy and him wouldn't mind taking the town away from me. And I could go back to Florida.
Wow. I'm curious, how old was he versus you?
Oh, he was old enough to be my dad. He was about my father's age.
Yeah, and
he was in his 40s.
And he had dealt with your grandfather, Roy, over the years.
Yes, yeah. He'd been partners with Roy for 20 years or so.
Wow. That's crazy. So he really said that to you. What did you say?
Well, I started to get in my car, man, and drive to Nashville. But then I turned around and I got the edge of town, you know, because I was afraid when I got there of what I might do to him, right? You know, if he were to go off on me again, I didn't know where I was going. I was going to have to maybe slap his jaws or something, you know. So I went back home and I called my granddad, you know, and Roy was a totally different type of guy than Nick, you know, and he basically heard it all, man. And he was very calm. You know, he wasn't like Nick. He didn't scream. He wasn't that type of person. He didn't have to. He had a lot more respect than Nick had when it came to working with wrestlers. Mm-hmm. And he told me, you know, he said, well, you know, kid, I'm going to look into it. And he says, I'll get back to you. Mm-hmm. You know, so 2 days later, he called up and he said, you know, he said, Ron, we're not going to charge you any booking fee anymore. You don't have to pay booking fee anymore. Mm. But he says, but that's going to be a little difficult for you now, because now you're going to have to get all your own wrestlers from here on out.
Wow.
So within days, though, you know, and that was a big deal, man. I mean, you know, I had one town. I was just going to run 2 days a week for a while. And now all of a sudden, I got to get my whole crew. So within days, I got Ron and Don Wright. Mm-hmm. They had been there. They lived up in just north of Knoxville. They were glad to come and work these shows. I got a guy named Rocky Smith, who was one of the original Infernos, man, heck of a worker that lived in the Tri-Cities. And I got him to work for me. I got some local wrestlers. I also got a commitment from Dale Lewis. I got Danny Hodge. I got a young Dutch Mantell and a guy from England, his partner, Dutch's partner, named John Foley. And they worked out of the office in Nashville, but they also worked for me every Friday and Saturday night. Mm. So at just 26 years of age, I was also booking my own shows and basically headed for success.
You know what? Over time, we've all known someone like your grandfather, Roy, someone who never had to raise their voice. And it was because the respect was expected. I mean, that's a great story. So tell us about some of the other territory experiences along that time.
Okay. About 4 months after I put together my first crew, I was dying, man, to get into the Knoxville Coliseum, to do a show in the Coliseum. The Coliseum had never had a wrestling match in it before. And I knew that for me to be successful in the future, I didn't want to stay out there in Chilhowee Park in that small building and outside, and it may rain on you in the summertime. Wrestling had always been there. And for whatever reason, John Cazana never wanted to try the Coliseum. So I called up Eddie Graham, who was the major stockholder of the Florida Territory. And it's where I'd cut my teeth as a promoter working for them. I used to run West Palm for them and some spot shows. And I asked if he could send me a wrestler for my first Knoxville Coliseum show. And he sent me 5 wrestlers. And not only that, but of the 5, he and his son came. And they wrestled Dutch Mantel and John Foley, who were my Southeastern tag champions. He sent his booker with him. They came too. Cowboy Bill Watts wrestled me for the Southeastern Championship. He sent Tony Charles and Kevin Sullivan.
Wow.
And they had two great matches on that card, that wow. first Coliseum card. And it was the first example of what I was always got from the Florida Territory. Whenever I asked for something, they were just bend over to work with me. Mm. And in return, since I had been a big star down there, I went and worked four shows in four different Florida cities for Eddie in the coming months after we did that event.
Wow. So many of us remember and really watched Kevin Sullivan mature. Do you remember how old Kevin Sullivan was then?
Kevin Sullivan was probably about 23 years old.
Wow.
You know, he was really, really young.
Wow.
Very, very young.
But was he as gifted as he was young?
Oh, my. He had it from the very beginning. He's like one of those guys that was destined to be a star.
Wow.
You know, some guys had it and some guys never could get it.
Yeah.
Kevin always had it. He was good right from the get-go.
You could just see it in him. Yeah.
Right.
All right. All right. So it sounds like a totally different experience than your Nashville one.
Yeah.
All right. So who else helped you get started?
Well, my next help came from one of the greatest promoters and owners in the sports history, really, man. And he was just across the Smoky Mountains from me in the Mid-Atlantic Territory, and that was Jim Crockett Sr. And I asked the senior if he could help me for my second Coliseum show. And could he send me somebody for that show? Because his television overlapped with mine, and people in Tennessee got to see some of his North Carolina talent. And he sent me Ric Flair and a bodybuilder named Ken Patera. And they had a fantastic match for me on that second card in the Coliseum.
Cool.
My third Coliseum show, which was at this point in my second year in Knoxville, I called Sam Muchnick in St. Louis. And I asked if he could send me someone for that show, for the third Coliseum show. And he sent me his booker and the former NWA world champion, Pat O'Connor. And Pat and I had become friends in the many trips I made to St. Louis during 1973 and 74. I was in St. Louis every other week, it seemed like. And I used to help him with figure the finishes there on a lot of nights. So O'Connor wrestled against me. I booked him with me on the show. I wanted to wrestle a former NWA world champion, and I was a heel at that point. Pat O'Connor was a great babyface, one of the greatest world champions of all time. And he let me beat him with his O'Connor roll. He had a famous hold that guys were doing it all over. Everybody copied his move. It was called the O'Connor roll. And so when we got to talking about what to do in the match, he asked me, and I said, I've taken your move and added something to it, Pat. I said, I want to reverse your O'Connor roll. He says, what are you talking about, kid?
Yeah.
And I said, well, I kind of explained it to him, and he was like, wow, because can you do that? And I go, heck yes, man, I've done it. And so, boy, that's what we had for a finish. I beat the former world heavyweight champion right in the middle of the ring with his own move.
Wow. And he was a great sport about it, evidently. So you did. You beat a former NWA world champion right there in Knoxville. Who else other than who you've talked about helped you along the way?
Well, the Memphis Territory did quite a bit between 1975 and 1979 till the war started in Knoxville in 79. And we swapped talent with them on many great super cards in each territory. They would run a big card there. I would send them guys out of my territory. I would run a big one in the Coliseum. They would send me guys out of theirs. And we had many matches where both territories' titles changed hands. They had a champion, and sometime he would come to Knoxville. We'd beat his champion, and then we'd have the guy that beat him go to Memphis and drop the belt back on the guy that he had beat before. So great relationship between 75 and 79. And depending, it kind of depended on who was the champion, but it all always greatly enhanced each territories when you did that type of thing. Then in the last stud cast, let's just talk about the last stud cast as an example. We got Mr. Wrestling too, Johnny Walker, from the Georgia owner, Jim Barnett. We got him for an entire week. He wrestled a Mongolian Stomper on most of those nights, with the Stomper winning all those matches, just about, except for the one in Dothan, because Wrestling 2 was going to be coming back to wrestle in Dothan on the following Friday night again. So that kind of brings us up to this studcast, man, where we're going to be getting some help again. This time it's going to come from Bill Watts in the Mid-South Territory. And that was just on the western side of our territory, out west of us. Bill had a territory that went basically from Oklahoma to Mississippi, a big territory. And Bill and I had worked together as a team and as opponents against each other in both the Georgia and the Florida territories from 1972 into the fall of 1974. So I had done a tremendous favor for Bill in 1978. I had this very talented young black wrestler named Sylvester Ritter. And I also had another black star in the territory at that time named Norvell Austin that we were calling the Junkyard Dog. That was the name we had for Norvell. and I couldn't keep both of them, but I really, really could see the future for Sylvester Ritter. I said, this guy's got it, you know. So I called up Bill and I said, I've got this guy. And I said, I think he's going to be perfect for you. I think he'd make a fantastic baby face. And we had such a good relationship. He had never offered him anything or told him anything. He said, send him to me. So Sylvester, the Sylvester Ritter became for Watts the biggest baby face star he ever had there.
Wow.
And he exploded that territory. And they did it. He took the Junkyard Dog deal another step beyond what I did with Norvell. Mm-hmm. He put this big old thick metal dog collar around his neck with a chain on it. And he called him the Junkyard Dog. And by golly, he was a big old boy, Sylvester Ritter.
Yeah.
And they just exploded that place over there. So Bill thanked me many times for the favor I did for him. So I called Bill up, you know, and so Bill's territory, like I said, went from Oklahoma to Mississippi. And because it butted up next to my territory, he ran Mississippi's towns and all his TV stations in Mississippi, especially on the eastern side of the state. Their signal came over into Mobile and to Montgomery. Pensacola could get some. So they knew who the Junkyard Dog was that he had over there. And he had become a star over there in that part of the country. But then all of a sudden, he's becoming a star in my part of the country, too. So this, the reason that I wanted him is all of a sudden we got a notice from the people with the Mobile building. There were three buildings there that they needed to put me into the 10,000-seat Mobile main arena.
Wow.
And they didn't give me a very big notice, so I called Bill. I said, can you do me a favor? Can you send me your Junkyard Dog for three shows?
Wow.
And he said, absolutely, Ron. Be glad to.
I got to mention this because I didn't really catch on to the Junkyard Dog until he was in WWE. And I think the cool thing that I've just learned here was Vince McMahon did not have to give him any attire, any uniform, any thought about his character. He brought his character to WWE at the time. He was what he was, and Vince knew, you don't play with this. This is going to work the way it is. Would you agree with that?
Oh, you better believe it, man. I mean, the guy was magnificent. He was unbelievably good, you know, and He was partners a lot with Jerry Stubbs. Jerry Stubbs, once he became Mr. Olympia, he went to Mid-South. Watts, I sent him to Watts. Watts said, can I use your Mr. Olympia? I said, heck yeah. I sent him over there, and And Stubbs became almost the biggest star as Junkyard Dog in that part of the country.
I think almost all the people in Alabama had heard of the Junkyard Dog. Maybe I was one of the few who had not at the time. But didn't they almost sell out the New Orleans Superdome, if that's possible, with one of the biggest crowds in wrestling history, with the Junkyard Dog in the main event? And was he also coming to Alabama for you?
Yes, he was in that. He was on that show. Not only was he on that show in the main event, but so was Jerry Stubbs as Mr. Olympia.
Wow!
And main event partners with Junkyard Dog. They drew 40,000 people.
God.
In the Superdome.
Wow! You know?
So I called Bill Watts and I said, "Can I use your Junkyard Dog for three shows?" And he says, "Yes, you can." And I put him in Pensacola on Sunday, Montgomery on a Monday, and Mobile in that 10,000-seat building on Tuesday. So, you know, Junkyard Dog, you know, was the first of three cards in that week, like I said, those three towns. And it was a huge card, even bigger than last week. We had those four main events. This show is going to have five main events, and it's going to be in the big building. So, opening match. Let me just go ahead and give you the card, man, for this one. It is a really, really quite a card, man. The opening match was going to be Eddie Boulder against, there was a new guy that was coming into the territory, masked guy called a Cuban Assassin. Charlie Cook was wrestling in masked guy called the Avenger. And then in the first of five main events was going to be a brass knucks match between Don Fargo and Dick Steinborn. Second main event was United States Junior Championship match with champion Tony Charles against Norvell Austin, the man who had held that belt 5 weeks earlier. Norvell had beaten Tony Charles for his belt, and then Tony got it back. The third main event was for the Southeastern Tag Championship. It was a no disqualification match. It was Rob and I defending against our tag belts against Dr. Bill Irwin and Randy Rose, managed by the Big C. The fourth main event was a special challenge match, no disqualification, Bob Armstrong versus Ron Bass, managed by Big C. And in the main event for the Southeastern Heavyweight Championship, Mongolian Stomper, managed by the Big C, defending against the Junkyard Dog, Sylvester Ritter.
Wow, that is a magnificent card. I tell you what, this has been an excellent first part of this Studcast, one of the greatest cards in Southeastern history and TV show. The TV show is going to be discussed after the break when this Studcast continues. We'll be right back. Hey, everybody, David Summerson. A lot of Studcast fans may have noticed that Ron has not done an Ask the Stud show lately. He had, for many years, a real close friend that recorded many shows on his YouTube Southeastern Rewind channel, but could no longer do them. If you are interested, or anyone that might be, that lives in the Knoxville, Tennessee area, and would like to work with the Stud to record about 2 or 3 hours of video one day a month, please have them contact the Stud on his Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, Facebook Messenger. And thanks for your consideration. All right, Studcast fans, welcome back in. This is part two of episode, can you believe this? Episode number 351. It's entitled Mid-South Junkyard Dog versus Stomper. Let's get back into it. Sylvester Ritter, the Junkyard Dog, was going to be in Pensacola Sunday, Montgomery on Monday, and on Tuesday, May 20th, 1980, in the 10,000-seat Mobile Main Arena. So what about the TV show for this card? I'm sure it had to be a big one. Set that one up for us.
Oh, yeah, man. It was a special one. And it required some extra thought and work to make sure that when we were piecing this together, that the right show ended up in the right markets. Because you had the Junkyard Dog only going to be in three cities, the Montgomery and the Mobile markets, and they were going to get, he was going to do a 2-minute interview. We're going to slide into both of those television shows. And Wrestling 2 was going to be wrestling the Stomper in the Dothan market. So you know, it took a little work to make sure all these shows got sent to the right place with the right interviews. So the TV show opened up with Charlie Platt by himself announcing that the championship match for this week had been changed. Last week we were looking at putting Tony Charles in there with his U.S. Junior Championship, but Charlie came on and he said there's been a little change here and wanted fans to know that they're going to be seeing Ron and Robert Fuller defend the Southeastern Tag Championship this week. And next week, Tony Charles will be defending his United States Junior Championship. So fans didn't seem to mind that. They weren't unhappy with it, that's for sure. Mm. And when Tony came to the set with his belt, you know, fans gave him a big hand.
Cool deal. All right, so how about the first TV match? Who was in that one?
Norvin Lawson, man, the man who's going to be facing Tony Charles for his belt in the coming week. And he was wearing the junior title belt just 5 weeks earlier. He had been the junior U.S. junior champion. And had very rarely did Tony Charles ever lose that belt. But Norvell had been one of the guys that beat him 5 weeks earlier. So he was greeted. Norvell wasn't very well liked. By a bevy of boos, naturally, and it didn't bother him, though. In fact, it maybe fired him up some, because he just tore right into his guy, and it didn't take him long, man, to hit his boy with one of those diving headbutts coming off the ropes, and he put a pretty quick ending to the first match. Then Tony and Charles, they watched an edited down version of that last podcast. We had that three-man United States Junior Championship match with Tony Charles, Don Fargo, and Dick Steinborn, all three involved in it. And we edited it down to where we had about 4 minutes of action there. And it showed Tony win the last fall in that match. When he did, Don Fargo and Dick Steinborn, they were both laying on the mat at that point. That was a tremendous match. Wow, it was wonderful. As soon as Tony beat them both back to back, then boy, that Expo Hall crowd exploded, and Tony got handed his belt in the video, and then all of a sudden Norvell, who had won about before this video started, the match before that, he just came straight to the set. He's going to confront Tony Charles, and so he was shouting at Charlie Platt, you know. He said, you know, you're incorrect at the beginning of the show here, Charlie Platt. He said, saying that Tony Charles is going to be defending his United States Junior Championship belt on TV next week. He said, because, you know, Tony Charles is no longer going to be the champion next Saturday, and it's going to be me that's defending the belt. You're wrong about that, right? So, Charles, he didn't have anything to say to Tony, really. And then Charles didn't get a chance to respond. Norvell just turned around and he strutted back to the dressing room, man. That's all he had to say is, I'm going to win the belt and I'll be defending the belt next week. So, and they had another chorus of boos on his way out, too.
Okay, so how about the second TV match?
Well, Don Fargo was in this one. It was one of the wrestlers that had been in that video, the Tony Charles video that he and Charlie had just watched in the first segment. And Fargo's next opponent, Dick Steinborn, he joined Charlie at the set. And Fargo had his fist taped, man, because it was going to be a brass knucks match against Steinborn all around the territory that week. Mm. So he loved to tape those fists. And these two, man, they had really developed a nasty hatred for each other. They did not like each other, Steinborn and Fargo. And during the match, Fargo spent more time focusing on Steinborn over at the set than his opponent that was in the ring. But it didn't keep him from knocking out his opponent before it was over. He popped him with a taped fist and hit him a couple of shots. And he sat down on him with his rear end, actually, to get the 1-2-3 count. So made it look real easy.
Wow. All right. So you are right about those two stud hating each other. Steinborn was a terrific wrestler when he wanted to be, but Fargo, he was just loopy. He was crazy.
That's a fact, Dave. No doubt about that. In fact, I got a little short story here I'm going to sort of throw in here, Dave, about Fargo. You know, one of the nights when back in this time frame, same time frame, I was coming out of Dothan on a Friday night on my way back to Pensacola, driving in the Florida Panhandle on Interstate 10. And I was doing about 70 miles an hour, and suddenly I got passed, man, by a car full of heels going about 100 miles an hour. They just zoomed past me, blew the horn because they really recognized it was my car.
Yeah.
And once they came, got even with me and were passing me, I looked over, and Don Fargo was laying on his stomach on the hood of the car and holding on by the front windshield where the windshield wipers were. And the car was swerving back and forth, and Fargo's legs were swinging off of one side of the car and onto the other side of the car, 100 miles an hour. I was like, what are they doing?
Wow. All right. So that, I mean, what are they, what were they doing? I mean, trying to kill him or what?
I don't know, man. I mean, they were just a car full of crazy heels, man, looking for something crazy to do. I mean, they probably did that every time they went home. I don't know. And only Fargo would have been dumb enough to get on the front of the hood, though, and hang on. So, wow. So anyway, so let's get back to the personality profile. That's what's coming up on this TV show. And Bob Armstrong was on the profile, and he had this TV trophy that he had won last week from the Stomper with him. And Charlie and him weren't speaking. Charlie wasn't talking to the Big C at this point, and they had they'd been going through a little nasty period between the two of them. And we were going to cut away in this personality profile to the Big C and Ron Bass and the Stomper, actually, too. So because Charlie didn't want the Big C on the set with him, that's kind of the way we had to do it. And Bob watched the video of the first match ever between him and Ron Bass. And man, it was a really nasty match. It was a really bloody match. And both of them ended up getting disqualified. And they were going to be coming back against each other again in this big show the coming week. And so this time, match was going to be a no disqualification. And both of them got disqualified the week before. And so there's a bandaged up Bob talking about the Big C and now having two big men to contend with. He had not only Ron Bass, but he had the Mongolian Stomper. And, Bob was saying during this profile that, he wished he had a way of being able to compete with both of them somehow. And I get an idea while this profile was on. I remember thinking back that, Bob needs some help, right? I mean, he's got two big guys here he's dealing with. So we'll kind of talk about that probably in next week's studcast. But in the cutaway, in the promo cutaway, in a separate studio, there was Big C. And there was old patched up Ron Bass. He had been busted up too. And Big C complimented him right away, telling him that he was sure that how long was, he said, I'm not sure you keep this up, how long Bob Armstrong's going to be able to last against you, Big Texan, And he says, Armstrong was lucky. He said, that wasn't a bull rope match. He goes, because that's your specialty. And he goes, we might get to one of those pretty soon, hopefully. And he said, I got to say right now to everybody out there, including you, Charlie Platt, that I'm not going to be responsible for any major injuries to Mr. Goody Two Shoes. I think that's what he called him. So he was all prepared. So then he got his Southeastern champion, Mongolian Stomper, to come up front. And he said, he's being challenged by Mr. Wrestling 2 for the last time in Dothan, Alabama. And then he goes, and then he's wrestling twice out of three nights. He's going to wrestle this crazy junkyard dog from Louisiana, right? He goes, I don't think we've even seen, he said, I don't think I've even seen this guy, but I hear this guy's a bad dude. And he goes, Stomper's going to put up the Southeastern belt against him. And, and he says, And in case he loses, he goes, Charlie Platt better have nothing to do with that. So Charlie was laughing when the cutaway ended. And he said, you know, he said, I got nothing to do with that. You know, what's going to happen to the Big C and to your stopper. And he goes, but he says, I will tell you something. He goes, I will be coming to both Montgomery and Mobile. And he says, I want to see what that junkyard dog is going to do to your stopper. And next, what Bob's going to do to Bass. So they got a huge pop on the end of the profile.
Wow. All right. Another great profile, Ron, no doubt. All right. So who was in the next TV match?
It was the Mongolian Stomper. And also, you know, it was also his first opportunity in a while to stampede the studio audience, man. He hadn't had a chance to do that. And wow, he did a great job of it. Man, Big C just carried the Stomper's championship belt in the ring, and he was just encouraging the Stomper to get him. You know, he used to try to track him down and get him to come to the ring. This time he was just turning him loose. Wow, and it was crazy in the studio as usual. So once again, after, order was restored a little bit, it really didn't take long than the match that the Stomper had to really make he gave a poor guy a miserable afternoon, I guess is a good way of putting it. And he left this dude laying, man, and he and Big C, they celebrated their victory. So then it was time for this third interview, where we're going to be placing those interviews, one from Mr. Wrestling 2 for the Dothan market, and two of them that were going in, one into the Montgomery market and the other into the Mobile TV market. So Wrestling 2's interview was as good as always, man. He always did great interviews. But I was literally blown away with how Sylvester Ritter, the Junkyard Dog, how much he had improved in the 2 years since 1978, since we sent him down over to Watts. And that's back in southeastern Knoxville days. And these interviews that both of these guys did is what me and Rob used to, and Bob used to look at each other when they would see some of these interviews. And we called it instant money.
Wow. All right, I guess it was time for the championship match of the week. You and Robert defending your tag belts.
Yeah, that's correct, man. And we had two pretty good opponents. Both of them were wearing masks. One of them was the new Cuban Assassin, and the Avenger had been there off and on for a few shows. While we were wrestling, Randy Rose and Dr. Bill Irwin went to the set with Charlie. Big C didn't go because he and Charlie were still feuding, and Charlie would have probably got up and left the set if he had. So I'm glad Big C didn't go. And Rose and Irwin, they spent their time at the set predicting the big victory they were going to get over me and Rob in the coming week. No DQ match, that's what they'd been wanting. And so our TV opponents sure didn't get a victory, I can tell you that. We were able to put the leg locks on both of them at the same time to end the match. And we got a big standing ovation. And as soon as we put those leg locks on those guys, we end up on our backs doing those holds. And they were giving up. Well, Rose and Irwin, man, they just left the set. They charged the ring, man. They were going to try to get us while we were down on our backs. And we were able both to get up. And we invited them to come on into the ring, man. And that studio was going crazy. They were thinking that they were, and they were thinking they were too. Big C came out and took them to the dressing room.
It sounds like another great one to me. The upcoming card alone was going to be something really special. So how did the big matches go the following week?
Eddie Boulder beat the newcomer called the Cuban Assassin, Charlie Cook. Got a win over the other mascot, the Avenger. Then in the first of five events, the Brass Knucks match with Don Fargo facing Dick Steinborn. Dick Steinborn got a victory over Don Fargo. Fargo's type of match. Pretty amazed at that one. Next event was for the United States Junior Heavyweight Championship. Champion Tony Charles was defending against the former champion Norvell Austin. This was a great match, man. Had a 30-minute time limit on it, and it ended up with a 30-minute time limit draw. Nobody got a win in that one. Next main event was the no disqualification match, the second meeting of Bob Armstrong and Ron Bass, managed by the Big C. And again, this ended up with both of them bleeding, and again, no winner. So they were going to be coming back the following week. We're going to put them in a best two out of three falls match, thinking maybe that it wouldn't be as bloody and as violent because you know, they'd get a little more wrestling. But we'll have to see about that match next week. Then the fourth match was for the Southeastern Tag Team Championship with Rob and I. We were defending for the second time against Dr. Bill Irwin and Randy Rose, managed by the Big C. This one was a no disqualification match. And the Big C got nowhere near Bob Armstrong in that match right before ours, but he made up for it in our match. Rose and I were going at it, and the referee was over with us, and I saw Robert put Irwin in the Fuller leg lock in the middle of the ring. And basically, but you know, I'm busy with Rose, and the referee's still there with me and Rose, and so I'm trying to not pay too much attention to what goes on from there. So I figure this match is over, man. Rob's got him in a toehold. This one's done. But the Big C came this end of the ring, but real slow like. He just walked over real slowly. Rob didn't see him. Rob's cracking the leg. He's not paying any attention. Big C loaded up the glove. Referee saw him. He went over and he tried to stop him, but it's a no DQ match. So he just pulled away from the referee. Boy, he got right over Rob, and he just dropped down on his knees and popped him in the forehead with that loaded glove. And wow, that was the end of it. And then he calmly got up, left the ring, walked out of the ring. The referee didn't have any choice. Irwin rolled over there and covered him. And what's he going to do? He had to count him out. So it was the second time in 3 weeks the Big C had done that to Rob. And it was the second time that it cost us the belts. And so it was the first Southeastern Championship, though, for Bill Irwin and Randy Rose. Last match of the night was the superstar, Junkyard Dog, taking on the Southeastern Champion, Mongolian Stomping by Big C. That building was wow. Well, they tore the building down in Montgomery, and they raised the roof on that 10,000-seater in Mobile the next night. I mean, Junkyard Dog got disqualified. He got his hands on Big C, flung him over into the ring, and he started putting a whipping on that boy. And, Stomper and Stomper 2. Well, he got disqualified. Junkyard Dog got disqualified. Didn't win the championship, but it was still a spectacular match.
Wow. All right. A great night, really great night for the fans. In not just Montgomery and Mobile, but also Pensacola, Florida, where the Junkyard Dog started his three-day run through Southeastern. How about the attendances in those three cities and in Dothan, Alabama?
I'm going to take it a little step further than what we normally do because this is such a big week. So I'm going to change up this. I'm going to give us the attendances for all six cities that week. Okay, we'll start with Pensacola, where the Dog was too. And Pensacola, that building sold out. We turned people away in all of our buildings that week. We didn't have big enough buildings. Pensacola had 5,200 in its building. Montgomery had all-time record 5,300 in the Civic Center there. Mobile sold out, 10,200 fans in the main arena. Panama City on Thursday had 3,100 people. Dothan on Friday with Mr. Wrestling 2 returning, take on the Stomper. They had a turnaway crowd too, 5,400. And on Saturday night, we ran in Oxford, Alabama, in the nice little building over there, and they had 3,000. So, it was a new Southeastern record for Southeastern, either company. When we were in Tennessee or in Gulf Coast, we did 32,700 fans in six nights.
That is pretty amazing. Almost 33,000 in six nights. That had to be getting close to some of the biggest territories in the world. And it happened in just two states, Alabama and Florida, right in that same Wiregrass region, I guess you would say. All right, so good news. It looks like we will have enough time for a learning tree question this week. We're going to work that in. This one comes from Fred Edelman. He says, I have never missed a Studcast. I'm intrigued by the ownership of Southeastern Gulf Coast. You were the majority stockholder. Did the other guys have equal percentages of ownership, or did some have more than others? Were dividends figured monthly? Did owners get paid only dividends, or did they get paid as wrestlers too when on a card?
Oh, that's a great question. It's a, several great questions, I'd tell you there, Mr. Edelman. Well, I can tell you, you know, on a week like the one we just talked about here, man, there were some big smiling faces at the end of every month. And so actually, I think that answers one of your questions. Were dividends paid monthly? They say were. And on this particular month, it was a very big, big smiling little party, you know, and which I think, you know, we had all deserved it. We had all been working hard. Every one of them I'm talking about now, every one of them, by every one, I mean Bob Armstrong. These are stockholders, Bob Armstrong, Robert, Jimmy Golden, and Roy Lee Welch, all owned different amounts of stock. And over the course of the almost 10 years that this company was in operation, they all four exchange some stock, man, in one way or another. One guy would buy 5%, another would sell 4%. You know, it was hard to keep up with who had what, you know, because they kept wanting to trade off here and there. So if they did summer, then, you know, and if they did something other than wrestling, it didn't make any difference. If they did something other than just wrestling in the ring, they got paid extra for it. You know, things like the booker, which was Rob. When Rob was booking, he would get paid as a booker besides his wrestling money. In Roy Lee's case, he would sometimes, when he wasn't wrestling, handle the box offices up front. And he would record the matches with our camera to be used on the TV shows on Saturdays. On a case like, what I did last week, you know, if I had to handle TV station stuff or building issues or getting with billboard companies, you know, then I would get paid something for doing that extra work. So all those things paid something extra, basically. Obviously, if you wrestle on the card, you were going to pay just like all the other wrestlers were. And by that, I mean the exact same amount as the other wrestlers got. We never got more than the wrestlers did.
Yeah.
Because they were it. They were made all the difference in the world. So it was about this time in 1980 that things really started to take off. And for about the next 7 years or so, this territory just kept getting better and better. I mean, we were blessed by the good Lord. There's no doubt about that. Thanks for your question, Mr. Edelman. That's a really good one. And also for your continued support. Since you're listening to all these studcasts, I really appreciate that as well.
Yeah, if he says he's listened to every studcast, including this one, he has invested many, many, many hours. This is episode number 351 of 1 Hour Shows. Listen, I've really enjoyed this studcast too. It has been loaded with history, as always. And regarding the learning tree question, it sounds like it was a very honest answer. I've found there's not much when it comes to questions that you won't answer. Speaking of that, where are you going to be taking us on the next studcast when we're ready to ride again?
Right. Well, I can answer that one for you. We're going to do another hidden history lesson. This one, I think we're going to do one more on Birmingham. This will be the last one for a while about Birmingham. And we're going to discuss in this one why that city was going to become so important in so many ways. And in 1980, we had no idea some of the ways that we were going to benefit from the purchase of Birmingham in northern Alabama and just how big that city was going to be for us.
Wow.
Our card for the next studcast is going to rival this one, basically. Another big one, man. And we have a lot of new wrestlers on their way into the territory at this point. And we are fast becoming one of the hottest territories in the world.
It's been so fascinating hearing about Sylvester Ritter and the origin of the Junkyard Dog in your territory. All right, listen, folks, it's so easy to get up with Ron and even have a back-and-forth conversation with Ron on Facebook. Find him at Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. Like, follow him there. Automatically become friends with a living legend. On Twitter, now known as X also, he's at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow him there, too. Check out the fantastic website, tnstud.com. This studcast is going to be there with every studcast ever done. Shop the stud store where you can get 43 super studcasts, 4 different 8x10 photos, the thrilling lion novel Brutus, personally autographed to you, and t-shirt still on sale, only $15.99 and free shipping on top of that. Plus, subscribe to the YouTube channel Southeastern Rewind. Find hundreds of hours of classic old school wrestling entertainment, 426 total videos, the last 130 studcast, 16 Ask the Stud shows, 115 short rides with the stud. Go back 1 year or more and discover fantastic stud stories about worldwide stars. 23 studcast archive stories, 23 more fan question shows, superstars of the past shows, and much more. That is YouTube Southeastern Rewind. When you go to YouTube on the search bar, put in Southeastern Rewind. It's the first thing that comes up. Y'all know it. It's the best deal in wrestling. All right. Any final comments, Stud?
Yeah, I just want to thank everybody, man, for listening today. And I hope you've enjoyed it out there. And tell somebody about us if you'd like to. You got friends that maybe don't know anything about what we do here. And please take care of yourselves and others, and may God bless us all.
For Ron Fuller in the Great Smoky Mountains of Tennessee, I'm David Summers saying thank you for listening. Find me at davidsummersproductions@gmail.com. This Studcast is a David Summers production for Tennessee Stud, LLC.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
1, 2, 3.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.